You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Douglas Starr. He's co-director of the Center for Science and Medical Journalism and a professor of journalism at Boston University. His first book, Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce, won the 1998 Los Angeles Times Book Prize and became a PBS TV documentary special. A veteran science, medical, and environmental reporter, Starr has contributed to many national publications, including Smithsonian, Audubon, National Wildlife, Sports Illustrated, The Los Angeles Times, Christian Science Monitor, and Time Magazine, and has served as a science editor for PBS TV. He lives in Boston, near Boston. Sorry. Anyway, he's here today to talk to you and show us a slideshow based on his newest book that's just come out called Killer of Little Shepherds. Please join me in welcoming Douglas Starr.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. So my name is Doug Starr, and my area is science and medical journalism. And I'm particularly interested in areas where science overlaps into the human drama. I don't write nerdy science. I write kind of dramatic science. And of course, one of the most dramatic areas of science everybody's talking about is this whole thing of forensics and CSI. And I've been interested in this in a long time. And I thought it would be interesting to write about the people who basically invented the field. And it was a coterie of very smart people, mostly in Europe, in the 1880s and 90s. And they invented everything we're talking about now, fingerprints, a blood spatter analysis, understanding the position of bodies at the crime scenes. Everything since then has just been variations on a theme. They're also really caught up in this question of what is the neurology of good and evil. And what made this time especially interesting is this was a time when the questions of good and evil went beyond the priests and the philosophers to the scientists, because they were sure if you looked hard enough into the human brain, you could find what it is that makes us do what we do. I should say this is happening right now, and the state of the art of neurology is people are doing brain scans with MRIs of the brains of psychotic killers and finding some very interesting patterns of neural development that are quite surprising. But this is the time, and when I was looking at these people, I also found the case of Joseph Vaché, who killed more than twice as many people as Jack the Ripper and really was the terror of Europe at the time. So this is his story, and the story of the scientists who apprehended him and used the new science of forensic science and criminal psychology to unravel the case. Now, what's fun about this story is the way I got it. So I tripped over the story, and as it happened, I'm pretty good in French, and the story took place in France. At the time, forensics in America was quite primitive, and this is the hero of the book, Dr. Alexandre Lacassagne. In addition to getting all of his records and reading everything he wrote, I went over there and started trying to pick up the trail of who this guy was. This is the remains of his criminal museum in Lyon, France. He founded something called the Institute of Legal Medicine, which was the first real scientific strike force to figure this stuff out. And what they did in these museums is they would preserve evidence from a crime scene and the weapons, and they would train young medical examiners to go and look at what matched up. So if a person was wounded with a particular knife, they would preserve the body or make a plastic cast of the body, put the knife next to it, have diagrams, and this the way, if one of the investigators went to the crime scene, they could say, where have I seen that before? Oh, yeah, in the museum. And one went with the other. And there were criminal museums all over Europe in the 1880s and 90s. And this is what's left of that. The morgue in Lyon was actually on a houseboat. And they thought this was a good idea because nobody wanted a morgue in their backyard. And, you know, the riverfront property was free, and they thought, great, the boat flows there. And it seemed like a good idea at the time. And he worked on this place for 30 years. The trouble is the Rhone River has a lot of barge traffic, and every time a really big barge would go by, the boat would start to rock, and sometimes water would splash in or the bodies would splash overboard. And during a storm, sometimes it would go careening into the water and hit a bridge and the bodies would go downstream. So it wasn't really ideal. And they would do these autopsies without masks and without gloves, and they were really heroic. Now, so Dr. Lacassagne, as I went into his life, he published a journal about forensic science. He was widely admired, and he collected evidence from his cases. And this is a wonderful case of a real tough guy named Gourmet, who killed an old woman, rather brutally. And the only evidence of interest that Lacassagne could find at the crime scene was Gourmet, for some deranged reason, had defecated at the crime scene, this woman's apartment. So Lacassagne, being a scientist, took a sample and analyzed it, and he found some very tiny pinworm eggs, which is a rather common parasite. And meanwhile, the police in Lyon had rounded up some suspect. So Lacassagne, by taking samples, I won't go into details, was able to match the pinworm eggs at the crime scene to this guy, Gourmet. And they found him guilty, sent him to the guillotine. But this guy was a tough nut. Nothing scared him. He had no love in his life. But just before the blade dropped, he said, "You know that scientist who figured it out, that Dr. Lacka, whatever?" They said, "Yeah." He said, "He's a smart guy. I'll tell you what. You give him my body after they cut up my head. Tell him it's a present from me." And still hangs in his lab. They reattached his head. And I found that. I saw that in his lab, and I asked one of the people, "What's that?" He said, "Oh, there's a story behind that." This is Dr. Lacassagne's great-granddaughter. She's a judge, a Superior Court judge in Lyon. And I talked to her at length. I said, "Do you have any memories of your great-grandfather?" She goes, "No, not really." And then there's this thing that happens to me sometimes when I'm on research trips. She said, "But I do have a box of old stuff. You wouldn't be interested in that, would you? If you go into my line of work, I have to give you a piece of advice. If you're ever confronted by a moment like that, try not to jump out of your chair and try not to grab the box out of her hand. Just say, 'Well, if you don't mind.'" And this was one of the things in the box. Because it turned out that her great-grandfather, an attorney to be, in addition to being an absolute genius, had a real mischievous sense of humor. And he liked to bring home evidence from his cases. And this is the bronze casting of the hand of a female criminal. And he brought it home and he used it as a paperweight. Now, the hand is not inside of this. It's just a casting. But this was his sense of humor. He also did this. He studied the tattoos of thousands of criminals because tattoos were thought to be an insight into criminal culture, and people still do study tattoos. But he wasn't content to just study the tattoos and write paper about them. He thought it would be fun to reproduce the tattoos on his dinnerware. So somebody would be eating dinner and come to the bottom of their beef bourguignon and find, anybody out here read French? Can anybody translate? "Death to French officials." Or this one. They're just at the bottom of their dinner and it comes across and it says, "The past tricked me, the present torments me, the future terrifies me." And this was actual tattoos. This was his country's home on the Loire. And his great-grandson, Dr. Denis Muller, welcomed me there. And this, I must say, I've been going back to France back and forth for 4 years. It takes a long time to win people's confidence. That's him. And of course, look at all those papers. You probably can't make this out, but that's a door knocker to the summer home. And you may see it's the shape of a female hand. Yes, it is the same hand. Oh my gosh. He was a real family man. That's him surrounded by family. He was a great guy. That's him surrounded by colleagues. And there were all these societies of anthropology and forensic science, because this was the dawn of modern science. And they're always meeting. This is his colleagues in Lyon. It was a really exciting time. Now, this is a postcard I found of his of when the Eiffel Tower was first built in 1889 for the big exposition. And, you know, science was going to save society, and they were very excited. But like our own times, it was a scary time. And there was this international movement of terrorism at the time. Has anybody here studied European history of the 19th century? Anarchism. And they were assassinating people and blowing things up all over the place. This was the assassination of President Carnot in Lyon by an Italian anarchist. Dr. Lacassagne happened to be in the crowd. And he tried to save him. He couldn't. And then he conducted a very scientific autopsy that made history. This is one of Lacassagne's colleagues in Paris, Dr. Alphonse Bertillon. before fingerprints were invented, he came upon this idea that if you measure 11 particular parts of the adult's body, the equation that puts those together is absolutely unique. And mathematically, and it was like the head, the finger, you know, certain immovable parts. And he had predictions that were accurate to 1 in 4 million. It was the most accurate thing before fingerprints. He also had the feeling that ears might be as unique as fingerprints, and he did tremendous studies of ears. Bertillon also studied the irises of the eyes, which we now know are unique, and they use them in identification. This was Dr. Cesare Lombroso of Italy. He had this theory of the criminal man. And if you look on my blog, you could see more about this. People didn't understand, why do people do horrible things? And he said, well, they must be born that way. And he studied the skulls of thousands and thousands of prisoners and came up with the notion that some people are born with certain deformities that indicates that they're evolutionary throwbacks. Like this. Like lantern jaws and jug ears and unibrow. And he actually would testify at trials, and based on his testimony about the way people look, some people were actually found guilty. Now, Lacassagne felt that it was how you were raised. This was Hans Grosse, the famous jurist from Austria. He was a pioneer in police procedures, and one of the things he said that I found most interesting, this was in the 1880s, he wrote as part of his book, "Torture is Absolutely Useless." 1880s. He said, if you want to interrogate somebody, the last thing you do is torture them or even yell at them. He said, make friends with them, put them at ease. Ask them the same question 15 different times to trip them up. He said, eventually, they will unburden themselves to you. People haven't learned that lesson. Now, on the other side was Joseph Vacher, one of the worst serial killers in history. And just as I had to follow Lacassagne, I had to follow this guy, which was a less desirable task. Here he is pictured in a way that he insisted on being photographs. The white rabbit fur hat represents purity. The keys in his hand were the keys to heaven, he felt. This was taken in the courtyard of a prison, and he actually borrowed the keys from a prison guard. This is where he was born. I found the house. That's my photograph. It's in the foothills south of Lyon. This is what I used to reconstruct this character. I found the courthouse where the trial took place, and it was another of the things. I talked to the woman, do you have such and such? She goes, you mean the Vacher case from 1898? She goes, we got some boxes. And they came up with like 8 boxes of papers, thousands of pages, and I photographed every one. And each page, or every 10 page, might have one little piece of testimony seeing this guy or what he was like as a kid. And I spent a year, you know, with the aid of a French assistant. I mean, reading the writing was hard enough. This is sort of where this guy roamed around. He was a prodigious walker. He could walk 20, 25 miles in a day. And he lived as a vagabond. Wherever you see a red cross is where he killed somebody. And his technique was he would kill somebody, eviscerate them, hide the body, and then walk into the next district, taking advantage of the fact that communication wasn't very good. In order to find some of these places, because Vacher was a real rural guy, I needed to have a friend and a guide. And I came upon this man named Rémy Cuisinier, self-taught amateur historian. He actually was a tile layer. And in his retirement, he became a real history enthusiast, wrote a manuscript about Vacher. After a discussion of 5 hours, he felt he could trust me. He said, I'll take you around. Let's have some adventures. So we would drive into the countryside and, based on the old autopsy reports and the old crime reports, figure out where had Vacher been. And then we'd ask people, do you know of such and such a place? Can you direct us to such and such a place until we found it? Here's the scene of one of the murders. Here's me taking notes. I have a real thing about nonfiction, and this book is nonfiction. And that means every single word is nonfiction. So if I said somebody was forced down on her back and she could feel the pine cones beneath her hands, it means I went to the scene of the crime and I laid down and felt pine cones beneath my hands. I don't buy any of this fictionalization stuff. If I say somebody thought something, it's because they wrote a letter that said, I was thinking the following thing. Here's one of the small towns where the crimes took place. And Rémy introduced me to the mayor and the previous mayor. He was like 95. And his great uncle was one of the villagers who eventually helped capture this guy. This was Vacher as a young soldier. And he fixated on this poor woman, Louise Barant. And when she rejected him after months and months of his pursuit, he tried to kill her and tried to kill himself. As a result of that, they sent him to a series of mental asylums. This is one of them, the Asylum Saint-Robert. And this is a very interesting time because instead of chaining insane people to the wall and squirting them with cold water and beating them because they were insane, they realized that if you were kind to them and spoke to them and treated them normally, they would develop normal patterns. And this is one of the new asylums, or what they call the age of the asylum. This is the current medical director of the asylum, Dr. Domel. And it was another one of those wonderful moments. I said, wouldn't it be cool if I could see the psychiatric records of this guy from 1893? No chance you have that, is there? And he took me to this room. He goes, well, look at this. And it's a file. And he said, I should tell you, here in France, we do have a very long statute of limitations. Technically, you shouldn't be allowed to photograph these things or really read them because of privacy concerns. And I just was quiet, which is often the best way to be. And he said, but you know, I've got a meeting at the other side of the asylum. Why don't you just come and get me when you need me? And so I got them all. This is the original psychiatric report, certificate of admission. Mr. Joseph Vacher, age 23 years old, submitted to the asylum for a crime for a medical exam. And at first he was docile and listens and is mostly sad. By the certificate of 15 days, he's been placed under observation because he's reaching a state of extreme excitement. The next report we have, November, was after he busted out and they had to bring him back in chains. This was one wild guy. This was his room at the asylum. I thought I should know what it looked like. Shortly after he was released, the asylum thought cured, his killing spree began. And in the typical tabloid way of the times, the newspaper sort of had a collage of all the horrible murders he committed. He lived as a drifter, and in between killing people, he'd be doing farm work and be put up by farm families. He stayed at this one family, and he took a liking to their little girl, so he decided to teach her penmanship and mathematics, which, as you could see, he did very well. He was educated in a Marist monastery for a couple of years before being dismissed for unspeakable acts. But he did four-figure equations, beautiful mathematics. The family was later horrified to find that their daughter was sitting on the lap of the worst serial killer in 400 years. This was the site of the worst crime, and it was the crime that brought him to trial. And these were some old farmers who's, you know, had ancestral memories of it. And in addition to telling me about what their grandparents told them, they could also tell me what life was like in the farms in the 1800s, because I needed to know what kind of farms did the kids, you know, pasture, what was life like. And this was the scene of one of the crimes. And this was another wonderful moment, because oftentimes when you're traveling in this country or foreign countries with rural people, you know, there's something called country smart, in which people may not have sophisticated manners, but they're very intelligent. And they're very apt to test somebody who they think is sophisticated to see how stupid we really are. And I could feel them testing me. And they're telling me all about it. I said, what's the name of that waterfall? Where did the cows come? Where was Victor assassinated? And I said, wait a minute, guys. I happened to have the original autopsy report, and it said that they found the body under a walnut tree. I don't see a walnut tree. And they got this wonderful smile, like, oh, he's all right. And I said, so, and they said, nice. They said, the tree was cut down in 1938. You're standing right where it was. I said, yes. So after the day, they brought me their wine cellar, and they said, oh, have our wine. And this was Emile Fourquet, the magistrate, who was the first one to figure out that a pattern of crimes was going on. And this was one of the many maps he made, trying to track back where had this guy been and what had he done. This is him interviewing Vacher in the courtyard. He finally got a confession at him by using Hans Grosse's techniques of gentle persuasion. And then Vacher immediately tried to make out like he was insane. And that was the real turning point of the view, how Dr. Lacassagne, using evidence from the crime scene, was able to show that he was not insane. This is Vacher's handwritten confession. And it basically says to France, you know, I take pity on you if you think I truly am legally responsible. This is the prison where they put him in Lyon, where for 5 months, Dr. Lacassagne interviewed him once or twice a week to try to get the truth out of him. Lacassagne, even though he was the most dedicated and unstoppable scientific crime hunter of his day, was beloved by prisoners because he was the only person that ever visited them, because he wanted to understand the criminal mind. Vache wouldn't crack. He hated Lacassagne to the end. This is the inside of the prison. So that's when Lacassagne turned to using the evidence to reconstruct what went on inside this guy's mind, which was why this was such a pivotal case. Vache never stopped obsessing about Louise, and this is a letter he wrote to her while he was in prison. But it didn't work out to him. This is an etching in the newspaper of the morning of his being taken to the guillotine. There were real arguments about capital punishment at the time. A lot of people thought it had gone too far. And one of the big things was, you know, they would execute somebody, and then they would always dissect his brain to find out what was wrong. And those who were opposed to capital punishment says, aren't you kind of going about this the wrong way? So this was a satirical cartoon. And you can see one of the brains on the shelf belongs to Vache. And the caption says, it's necessary to guillotine people because the only way to find out if they're legally responsible is to dissect their brains. That's a plaster cast of Vache's brain. It's now sitting in a warehouse in Paris with some other materials. And that brings us up to the present. What I wanted to do, if you got a few moments, with that as the background, because that's a backstory, just read about four or five short segments of the book so you could see how this adventure led to the actual book, because it really was an adventure. So I've got a short passage about when Louise meets Joseph Vache, a slightly longer passage about what life was like at the time, a little bit about Lacassagne, just a tiny quote about what people were thinking of with the insanity defense, and then a scene from the trial, because it was a wild, wild trial. I should say there's an epigram at the beginning of the book, and I came across this quote. You know, President McKinley was assassinated by an anarchist, and they put him to death, and then they did an autopsy of his brain. And the doctor who did the autopsy, the American doctor named Edward Spitzka, wrote the following thing, because he did the autopsy to find out, was this guy crazy? And he wrote, "The wild beast slumbers in us all. It is not always necessary to invoke insanity to explain its awakening." And I thought, what a wonderful theme for this whole book. So here's the opening scene. On a drizzly spring evening in 1893, in the French provincial city of Besançon, 19-year-old Louise Barrant was walking along the riverside promenade when she crossed paths with a man wearing the dress uniform of the French army. His name was Joseph Vache. "Ugly weather, isn't it?" he said. And automatically she responded, "For sure." Normally, Louise would not have spoken to a stranger, especially one as brutish-looking as he. But Vache projected a kind of disarming innocence, and the sergeant's stripes on his sleeve reassured her. So they chatted and walked and shared dinner in a cafe. They learned that they both came from small towns. And as they lingered over shared stories about their pasts, he told her that he never felt comfortable with anyone before. And she, too, sensed that she could speak freely and easily. Yet she felt a shiver of doubt when she looked up from her meal and saw his eyes burning into her. Later that evening, he ardently proposed marriage. When he vowed that he would kill her if she ever betrayed him, she realized she had made a terrible mistake. So that's how it begins. And then he does something bad. This puts it in the context of what was going on then. Joseph Vache walked into history at a time of expectation and dread. The period at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th was an era of peace and prosperity, of advances in science and the arts. It was a time when Sarah Bernhardt lit up the stage and Toulouse-Lautrec illuminated the art world, when Gustave Eiffel was building his tower and Louis Pasteur was developing his germ theory of infection. Everything seemed bigger, faster, newer, more efficient. The new train networks sped passengers across continents, and steamships bore them rapidly across the seas. Telegraphs carried messages at the speed of light across the countryside and under the Atlantic. The Olympics were revived. The cinema was born. Modern burlesque halls opened in Paris. People could truly aspire to enjoy life and not just endure it. They shopped in the new department stores, bought the new ready-to-wear clothing, and pedaled their new bicycles, which had taken the middle class by storm. Women especially flocked to the bicycle as an independent means of transportation. Posters and full-color newspaper ads portrayed the new customers as liberated goddesses flying naked across the heavens on their bikes. Yet, under the optimism ran an undercurrent of dread. For every happy, well-off family, many more lived in poverty and destitution. Everyone could sense the instability. Anarchism, an international terrorist movement, was growing. Bombs were exploding at markets, government, and offices. The authorities responded with brutal repression, and the cycle of reprisals continued. Crime rates were rising, and the fear among the populace was inflamed by the new tabloid press. It wasn't simply crime that alarmed people, but the emergence of a criminal class. In this climate of hope and anxiety, an international group of experts emerged who took its scientific approach to solving crime. Like the other great logicians of the era, they viewed the problem not as sin or the workings of the devil, but as a scientific challenge. Trained in medicine, law, psychology, and anthropology, they established new institutes for criminal research, published their work in scholarly journals, and debated their theories in international conferences. They were the first generations of modern criminologists, and they developed the techniques that characterize the science to this day. They learned to read meaning into the chaos of a crime scene by measuring and mapping, by recording scuff marks, prints, and fibers, by performing methodical autopsies and collecting biological samples. To understand larger patterns of crime, they created databases. To explore the roots of deviant behavior, they dissected the brains of executed criminals. Their studies opened realms of discussions formerly reserved for priests and philosophers. What impulses for good and evil naturally exist within human beings? What modifies those impulses along the way? What are the limits of free will and sanity? Can the impulse to do evil be understood, predicted, redirected, or cured? And those questions are still unsolved. Here's a short section about who Dr. Lacassagne was. He rose to fame on a case called the Case of the Bloody Trunk, in which south of Lyon they found a body in a trunk, couldn't identify it, buried it, and then an inspector in Paris had a hunch, and he said, you got to dig up that trunk again and identify the body. By now it was months and months old, and Dr. Lacassagne, by doing techniques that you know you'd read about in Sherlock Holmes, identified the body. And I should say, one of the things I did, he had the experience of doing an autopsy on a highly putrefied body, and I thought that I couldn't honestly write about that without getting a sense of that. So when I was in Lyon one of the times, I called the current head of the Institute of Legal Medicine. I said, would it be okay if I sat in on a couple of criminal autopsies, knowing that I really didn't want to? And he said, yeah, I'll call you next time something turns up. So he calls me, he says, meet me in my office at 9:30. And that's what I saw. So one was a woman who killed herself with a shotgun. It was just an awful mess. And it, again, there was this testing thing. I was looking and trying not to throw up because I'd never seen this. And he says, oh, Doug, come look very closely inside the skull. You could see the fragments of such and such, you know, trying to see if I'd lose it. And I'd go. And then I'd walk to the far end of the room pretending to take notes. And what I was doing is really, you know, steadying my stomach. And then in the next room, there was this ghastly smell. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, that's a very old body. Surely you're interested in that. It was a very decomposed body. So that's how I was able to write about this. And I won't read that part because it's a little sickening. But I'll tell you a bit about Lacassagne. Dr. Alexander Lacassagne already was well-respected in his field when he encountered the case that would make him world-famous. As one of the early scholars of legal medicine, he had helped devise many of the new techniques in crime scene analysis, such as determining how long a body had been putrefying and how to match a bullet to a gun. He showed investigators how to determine whether a dead body had been moved by examining the pattern of blood splotches on the skin. He developed procedures by which even simple country doctors could perform professional autopsies if called to a crime scene. Colleagues admired him not only for his contribution to science, but as a scholar, teacher, and friend. As people often did in those days, they saw his character revealed in his appearance, and a noble physiognomy it was, with his high forehead, handlebar mustache, burgomaster's girth, and his strong rhythmic step and ever cheerful eye. With his energy and talent, he could have done anything, but he chose the new field of criminology. To his mind, it encompassed the scale of human experience, from the workings of a single brain to the forces that shape civilization. But even that occupied only a small part of his intellect. He immersed himself in poetry, philosophy, literature, and art. He could recite from memory pages of a Dante in the original Italian and entire acts of plays. He sponsored young artists. He was never without a book, either reading one or writing one. His friends thought him as a Renaissance man, except for one little flaw. He lacked the ability to appreciate music. And just two small things. I'm about to tell you about the trial, but there's one quote I must read you. This whole thing about the insanity defense was driving people nuts because under French law, if you were insane, you legally had not committed a crime because your symptoms did. And what they would do is put you in an asylum. But if they put you in asylum, you could probably break out or be pronounced cured and go and kill again. So people were arguing this on the eve of the trial. And some people even thought that you had to remove such people from the breeding pool. And this is a quote from a highly respected science on the eve of the trial, talking about, you know, the criminal type just cannot be allowed to breed and you can't keep them in jail. And here's how he put it. It was Maurice de Fleury. And he said, "We care for them. We raise them in cages. We preserve them from death. For what purpose, God Almighty? Is it really human to allow these monsters, these creatures of darkness, these nightmarish larvae to even breathe? Do you not think to the contrary, that it would be more pious to kill them, to do away with that ugliness and unconsciousness that cannot be made noble? I glimpse the possibility of the legal, authorized elimination of all these incurable beings. Death without suffering, almost a consolation, a release, a gentle death, hardly sad, and annihilating all that useless ugliness and the intolerable feigned horror of all that evil without reason." So with all that going on, the trial begins, and it is a circus. There, it's in the small town of Bourg-en-Bresse. There is a crowd outside banging on the door, screaming death to the assassin. They had to call out a regiment of a crack brigade to keep them outside. The Dreyfus trial was just starting. The whole press was inflamed. All of Europe was inflamed. America sent reporters to cover up this. This was the trial of the year. And the judge is in no mood for this, whereas Vacher, who's trying to prove his insanity, thinks this is the best thing that ever happened because he is going to turn this thing into a circus. So the judge, who at the time was called the president of the court, his name is Ademir de Coston, and the scene is the reporters are there, the people are there. It's already looking like a bazaar. There's nearly a riot outside, and in walks Vacher. At 8:40 a.m., Vacher, surrounded by guards, marched into the courtroom wearing his white rabbit fur hat. With his head up, eyes directed halfway to heaven, he seemed to affect the posture of a saint. But his portrayal was unconvincing. His raggedy beard, which came to a point under his chin, made him appear satanic. His right eye, half closed with paralysis, exaggerated the emotions portrayed by the left, which in its frantic wanderings gave him an alternately ferocious and desperate look. With his claw-like fingernails and hyperactive limbs, he seemed less a martyred saint than a barely controlled animal. He brandished a rolled-up sheaf of papers. "Glory to Jesus," he proclaimed. "Long live Joan of Arc. Glory to the great martyrs of our times. Glory to the Savior." And then, incongruously, "He who only hears the bell ring only hears a sound." Vacher briefly fumbled with his cap as the president of the court, Ademir de Coston, entered, wearing the traditional red robes. He had heard all the commotion, and he did not intend to tolerate indignities. He pinned Vacher with a stare. "Listen to me well," he commanded the defendant. "I will not put up with any violence in this room. On your part, all your gestures and demonstrations will be useless. You are not going to behave here as you did in prison. I'm absolutely firm, and will use all the powers of the law and restrain you by force if necessary. Remember that." Vacher stood silent. DeCostone turned his attention to the audience and warned them, too, not to misbehave. "I noticed several ladies in the room," he added. "I should warn them that during these discussions there will be some things that are a bit difficult for feminine ears, so I would encourage them to leave." "We waited several minutes," wrote one reporter. "Nobody left, and then we all started laughing." So that's the scene. So if there are any questions, I'll take them. A perfect topic for Halloween. Yes?
It seems I'm grasping here for how often autopsies are performed. And it's, for some reason, it seems to me in the Minneapolis Park Board, if a death occurs on park board property, an autopsy is required. I happen to learn that because a gentleman that I knew fell on a trail in Minneapolis within the last 3 weeks, and his family was told that they have to perform an autopsy because it occurred on this public property, unexplained. Otherwise, is your sense that autopsies are sort of discretionary with it?
It's generally in the sense, if it's a suspicious thing, often the family member tries to prevent an autopsy. I know in Massachusetts, where I'm from, often the politicians get involved, and they don't want the real reason for the death to come out. It can be a very political thing. And by the way, you could look online, and I have a website connected to this, and there's an opinion piece I wrote in the Boston Globe saying that the CSI labs you see on TV are a complete fabrication. That is not like that. These things are underfunded. They are backed up for weeks. There's political pressure. There were many cases. There was a very famous case of a West Virginia crime lab guy who simply made up all the results over a period of 2 decades, and several people were put to death based on his made-up results simply because he wanted to agree with the cops. A scandal just broke in North Carolina. They're having to re-examine nearly 200 cases. A scandal just broke in San Francisco. They had to throw out more than 700 drug convictions, emptying 20% of the prison. So this is going to be in the news a lot more, and I'll be writing about that more, that this whole American fantasy of these people at CSI who are watching our backs is just sort of a daydream. And it's very interesting. I was talking to a medical examiner a few days ago, and she helped me. One of the things I had to do, in addition to translating from French to English, was translate from 19th century science to 21st century science. And the way that I do that is, after understanding these things, I would call experts and say, what do you think this means? You know, what was this guy really looking at when he described this? What is this syndrome? I also spoke to modern forensic psychologists, because they had words like monomania instead of psychosis. And this coroner I spoke to said, boy, I wish Lacassagne was my boss. He said, they did it right. So this is an issue.
Do we have to read the book to find out the... So does it develop more about the evolution of thinking about the insanity?
What I do is, the book kind of reads like a movie. This book.
The way you ended that presentation was like leaving me on the edge of my
seat. I'll get to that. this book is kind of encyclopedia. It was sort of like a 400-year investigation of how blood became a global commodity, from the first experiments to all the secret shipments during World War II, because it was strategic to the AIDS epidemic and to the exploitation of people in Central America. It was a massive thing. I wanted this thing to be a story, so it reads like you're watching a movie. But at the end, I do have an epilogue that brings it up to the 21st century, because I didn't think it was right just to leave it in 1898 and say, so there you are, because single people think, well, what do they do now? What do they mean now? And so I do bring it up, but just in an epilogue. The thing itself is a story. It goes back and forth between the killer and the odd chapters and the scientists, and then they come together. And I have to thank Gordy up front, who, many of these things were quite disgusting and horrible, especially since I began with autopsy reports. And I'd come back from every trip brimming with stories, which my wife found too disgusting to listen to at the dinner table. But Gordy and his brother thought it was the most wonderful thing. So they encouraged me all the way through. And the way I wrote it in order to keep continuity is, first I wrote the Vacher chapters, and then wrote the Lacassagne chapters, and then blended them. And at one point I gave Gordy the Vacher chapter and said, look, does this track? Does this keep your attention? And he was able to give me some very helpful advice. So I publicly thank him. I have to mention a really cool thing that happened in terms of the 21st century. I was interviewing forensic psychologists, these people who get to know serial killers, and one was a very well-known one, and I talked to her for 3 hours, and she's talking about how psychotics, you know, when they get a psychotic in the institute, you instantly know it because their eyes, there's a flatness. It's like lights on, nobody home. She said, you can see their lack of empathy, the sociopaths, it's just, there's nothing there. It's like they're animated. And I said, do any cases stand out in your mind? And she said, well, there was one. And I don't know if you guys heard about the BTK killer. He was apprehended in, was it Kansas?
What does BTK stand for?
Bind, torture, and kill. He was like a church deacon who killed 10 or so people over many years. And horrible.
A security guard, or like he would install security systems in people's homes.
Yeah. And you never would have guessed. And she said, that case stands out in my mind. And I said, why? And she said, when I looked into his eyes, I was not looking at dead eyes. She said, I was looking into the abyss. And I said, come on. You're a scientist. Did you hear yourself? She goes, I know. I'm embarrassed. But I felt like I was, for the first time in my career and the only time, looking into the face of evil. And she said, you know what? Here's another thing. Ever since then, something's been hanging over me. And she said, I have a good life, but it's not like it was. She says, things are going wrong. She says, something brushed up against me with that case. And I said, holy shit. So that's, it's out there. And we don't know, you know, and I think the point is that these were the people who said, not only, you know, how do you construct a crime scene from evidence, because you can't rely on what people tell you, you know, how do you really arrive at justice, but more so is, what is it in the human soul? How come the vast majority of us are just regular people getting through the day, and there is this tiny, tiny number of people that do these horrible things? And the investigation continues, and that's what it's about.
Doug, can I ask you another question?
No. No.
Yes.
Do you think that in terms of the criminal mind, like, would you classify, say, like a Bernie Madoff kind of person, or somebody who does, like, not gruesome physical white collar crime? Yeah. Do you think that they would classify that in the same category?
These guys?
Yeah.
Well, they. I tell you what I think. One of the really frustrating things, most of the stuff I do involves the present. And this, even though it started in the 1600s, it ended up with the AIDS epidemic. So I was hanging out with those people all over the world protesting how the blood got infected. It was present. Everybody here has been dead for over 100 years. And I so much wanted to pick up the phone and say, what were you thinking? Or this week is missing. What happened? And it was so frustrating. And I had to dig deeper and deeper into what they wrote or what somebody wrote about them. I mean, it was monstrous. But so I can't tell you what they thought about somebody like Bernie Madoff. But when I was learning more about antisocial personality disorders and sociopathies, they, you know, and that is, if somebody is a sociopath, they are born without the ability to feel empathy. It's just the way they are. It's not treatable. And they will do whatever it takes to advance their own agenda. And it turns out that a lot of sociopaths end up as criminal, and a lot of them do very well in corporate business. And I would think that Bernie Madoff might have been one of those. I also think he's one of the kind. Lombroso, who characterized people, had all sorts of classifications of criminals, and one was called a criminaloid, a criminoid type, with a mattoid mentality. And that meant somebody who was weak-willed and kind of by circumstances ended up in crime and ended up convincing himself that it was okay. That kind of sounds like Bernie Madoff. Maybe he was a criminoid. So, yeah, every moment I was writing this, I thought, this could have come out of today's headlines. So.
You haven't said anything about profiling.
They did. Yeah.
What did the investigator did he do some profile? This is
That guy 4K with the glasses. He did. He was brilliant. He there was a grisly murder in his district, and unlike everybody else, he really started collecting facts. And I have several chapters on him, and he'd stay up way into the night, listing facts, drawing charts of evidence at the crime scene, tiny bits of what people observed, and then he would circle in blue everything that seemed to match up, And he analyzed more than 85 crimes because reports started coming in from all over France. And he came up with a profile of this guy. Here's his method. Here's what he looks like. Here's his method of killing. And when the guy fell into the hands of the police purely by accident in some small town, and 4K read about this, he dashed off a telegraph. He said, don't let this guy go. I think this might be the guy. And they shipped him down. And then in the course of his interrogation, which took weeks, it came out. So yeah, they pioneered that too. Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. It was fun to talk about it.